Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another GSF event. Today we are commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which is something which has suffused a lot of the talks we've had over the last 10 years. But today we thought we would concentrate particularly on it because of the implications of it over those 100 years. And I've got two very erudite speakers who I will introduce in a moment to speak on that subject. But before I do that, just to let you know that next week, on the 7th of June, because we've got the parliamentary recess coming up, on the 7th of June, you may be violet from next door. We have a lecture given by Professor Michael Mandelbaum, who is a Christian A. Hurt Professor of American Foreign Policy at the John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's going to talk on the past, present, and future of American foreign policy. So if any of you would like to come to that, do let Jackie know as you leave, and I'm sure we'll make arrangements that you are asked. But today, as I say, we're looking at the Sykes-Picot Agreement. We've got two, as I say, erudite speakers. On my right, who's going to speak first, Eugene Rogan, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Oxford, and the director of the Middle East Centre at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. He has written a number of books. He's the author of The Arabs, A History, which was named one of the best books of 2009 by The Economist and other newspapers. His new book, The Fall of the Ottomans, The Great War in the Middle East, I think is on sale here today.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sure if you buy one, he will sign it for you.
With pleasure.
He says, price £10. Seems very reasonable to me. His earlier works include Frontiers of the State in the Late Ottoman Empire, for which he received the Albert Hourani Book Award, and The War for Palestine, Rewriting the History of 1948. So he has written a number of books all to do with this area, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say about Sykes-Picot. And then on my left, some of you may recognise from Question Time and other television performances, Peter Oborne, who is the former chief political commentator of The Telegraph. He writes a weekly column now for the Middle East Eye and the Daily Mail. He's written a number of books identifying the power structures that lurk behind political discourse, including The Triumph of the Political Class and The Rise of Political Lying. He appears, as I say, on Question Time, and he often presents the week in Westminster. He was the voted columnist of the year at Press Awards in 2013. More importantly, as some of you know who have read his articles, he frequently travels in the Middle East and North Africa and goes to all the places that a number of us would be rather less keen to go to if he could help it. And as a result, he brings a sort of on-the-spot element to today's address. I'm very much looking forward to hearing from him. So without more ado, I'm going to ask Eugene Rogan if he would talk to us for about a quarter of an hour.
Lord Lothian, your excellencies, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, I know I don't have to say that, but it always feels good. It's a great pleasure to be speaking to such a distinguished audience and on such an occasion. The benefit of centenaries is it gives us a bit of perspective to come back to history. No historian expects to have the discussion of events 100 years ago seem as relevant as they do for the Middle Eastern historian. So I suppose in that, those in my profession have a distinct advantage. And I think that Sykes-Picot has taken pride of place in discussions really since that fateful moment 2 years ago when Daesh broke through the burn separating Iraq and Syria and declared it the shattering of Sykes-Picot. Now, we talk about Sykes-Picot in a way which is kind of anachronistic. And being an historian, I feel it my duty to try and bring things back into correct historical perspective. In fact, I think that my colleagues in the writing of the history of the wartime diplomacy all err in terms of viewing that diplomacy against the background of the emergence of nationalism in the Middle East, and that diplomacy stands as the ultimate betrayal of the national aspirations of the people in the region. In writing my recent book on the First World War in the Middle East, I tried to cast that diplomacy instead against the background of the Great War. And I think it makes a tremendous difference in the way we analyze what the diplomats were trying to achieve by this process of wartime partition diplomacy, which evolved right through the full 4 years of the conflict. And in that way, I'd like to dispense with a couple of common myths. So, the first myth is to say that the diplomacy took place in a bell jar. It did not. It took place in the context of a murderous global war in which tens, indeed in some months, hundreds of thousands of casualties were being suffered on both sides, and in which, basically, the governments involved would have promised anything to anyone that might make a decisive edge in winning that war. The wartime agreements don't make sense against in any other context. That is the only way that they make sense. It is thus a common mistake to assess Britain's support for Arab aspirations or Zionist aspirations, and then to talk about the way in which this wartime partition diplomacy represented betrayals. I would stress that Britain was really only loyal to its own empire, that no Briton in Whitehall or in the battlefield was thinking about anything other than Britain's victory in the Great War and what would advance the cause of the British Empire in victory after that war. As part of that, remember that nationalism is the water that dissolves empire. If you want to look at the greatest source of threat to empire, it would be nationalism. So I put to you, it would be inconsistent with any British government official to do anything in 1914 to 1918 to encourage nationalism, particularly in territory in which Britain had a strategic imperial interest, such as the Middle East. That will apply towards the kind of promises that the High Commissioner in Egypt, Sir Henry McMahon, was making with the Sharifs in Mecca. That will also apply with the promises that the government were making to the Zionist movement in the Balfour Declaration. Those agreements were concluded not to advance an Arab national or a Jewish national movement. Rather, they were put forward to try and conclude strategic alliances with parties that those in the war cabinet believed might make some difference towards advancing the goal of winning the war against Germany. Those agreements then were concluded to advance victory in the Great War and to advance the position of the British Empire after the Great War, but not to create a Jewish Commonwealth in Palestine, not to create an Arab kingdom in the Levant and the Arab Peninsula. The borders that resulted from partition diplomacy have endured into the 21st century. So this was, as it were, very influential diplomacy. But as we know, so too have the conflicts engendered by the way those borders were drafted. And I would say that if there is an enduring flaw that lay in the wartime partition diplomacy, it's that the process by which the boundaries were negotiated and applied to this region were arrived at not in a process of consultation with the people who would live within those boundaries. It was arrived at without the consent of the people who would be the nationals of the countries emerging from this new state system, but rather was arrived at in an effort to achieve a balance of power politics between Britain and its imperial rivals. In a sense, we can see the wartime diplomacy, I take our history a little further back, as a solution to that long-running 19th century question known as the Eastern Question, which had at its heart what to do with the geostrategic territory of the Ottoman Empire against the inability of the Ottoman state to protect its territory against European imperial ambitions, and how to control European ambitions in Ottoman territory in a way to prevent European conflicts. That's what the Eastern Question is all about. World War I was the moment to answer it. That was answered through the wartime diplomacy. As a little hint on where I'm going with this, I would say that at that level, not only did this flawed process build tensions into the borders, we need only think about, let us say, Kurdish national claims, or indeed rival claims between Palestinians and Israelis over the territory of Mandate Palestine, to have a sense of that. But it even failed to achieve an enduring balance between imperial rivals. Because if you take a moment to look at the map of the Sykes-Picot Agreement and what it promised to Britain and France, and compare it with the map that emerges at the San Remo meeting in 1920, which is really what looks like the map of the modern Middle East. I mean, Sykes-Picot is not that. The one thing you can say is the French must have come away and said, blast those British. They've done it again. They promised us the moon, and they gave us a very small piece of the earth. But let me talk about the wartime diplomacy in the sort of 8 minutes remaining to me. Because we talk about Sykes-Picot as though it were the agreement that gave us the modern state system of the Middle East. And what I would like us to see is Sykes-Picot as a term is shorthand for a wartime policy of partition diplomacy that was actually opened on the eve of the Gallipoli campaign with the Constantinople Agreement in 1915 and is only really concluded in the San Remo Agreement of 1920 at the height of the Paris peace process at the end of the war. And in that configuration, Sykes-Picot is really only the midway mark. It's only the milestone halfway through this process. So let me bring back into focus something probably very few of you have paid much attention to, which is the first of the part-time partition diplomacy agreements, which is the Constantinople Agreement of March 1915. In March of 1915, the Allies are planning their campaign to force the Straits of the Dardanelles, seize the Ottoman capital, Constantinople, or Istanbul, and knock the Turks out of the war, to put an end to the threat posed by jihad threats that the Ottomans had raised, and to allow the Allies to reconnect from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea, to give them more flexibility in combating Germany and Austria from the east and the west as a combined force. So they knew why they were going into the Dardanelles, but it spelled to them the imminent fall of the Ottoman Empire. And Russia, of all the Entente powers, knew precisely the territory it wanted from the Ottoman Empire. It wanted Constantinople, the ancient Byzantine capital, for an Orthodox Christian restoration after 5 centuries of Ottoman rule. But more important than that cultural capital, they also wanted the Straits and the Sea of Marmara to ensure that Russian shipping, both trade, 50% of Russia's trade, transited those straits, and for naval power, that the Black Sea Fleet would have access to the Mediterranean under waterways that Russia controlled. They convened Britain and France, their Entente powers, to put this historic request to their allies. France was willing to concede to these demands in return to be granted Cilicia and Syria, vague, unbounded territories last defined by the Romans, but the British, French, and Russians seemed to know what France was asking for and conceded that. And here's the interesting clincher. In 1915, this is concluded in March of 1915, Britain had no territorial ambitions in the Ottoman Empire. It is confirmed in the terms of the Constantinople Agreement. The British government said they were willing to concede the richest prize of the entire war, Constantinople and the Straits, to Russia, and was willing to concede to French demands, but reserved the right to demand territory of equal strategic importance when it decided what that might be. So we really know from the terms of the Constantinople Agreement that Britain entered the war with no territorial ambitions. All of its 19th century policies had been towards preserving the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire as a buffer between land forces, keeping the Russians separated from Central Europe through an Ottoman Empire. That was to change. And it was to change when, as the war goes on, Britain finds that instead of a quick defeat of the Ottoman Empire, they're getting bogged down in an Ottoman front in which they're actually suffering reversals and defeats. The first reversal comes in Gallipoli. And it's only as they realize that they're going to have to evacuate Gallipoli without succeeding that British negotiations with the Sharifs of Mecca begin to really gain momentum to arrive at an agreement that will open an internal front against the Ottoman Empire to compensate for the British failure in the Dardanelles. And it's in the fateful letter between McMahon and Sharif Hussein at the 25th of October, 1915, that Britain actually concedes to the extensive territorial demands that the Sharifs were making on behalf of the Arab movement. But it's very important to stress that Britain would never have conceded such territory to the idea of an Arab kingdom absent the context of the war. And it is my contention that they only did so because of the importance of getting the Arabs to open an internal front against the Ottomans. No sooner had they concluded that agreement than, of course, they knew that they had to put some boundaries on these vague Roman provinces that France was claiming under the names of Syria and Cilicia, already established in the Constantinople Agreement. And that, dear colleagues, is the background of Sykes-Picot. That exercise was just to put boundaries on Syria and Cilicia and to ensure that in the promises Britain was making to a minor ally, the Hashemites, it was not querying relations with the major ally, the French. The whole experience leading up to the Entente Cordiale of 1904 had shown Britain what imperial rivalries did, what the weight of those were. And so it was quite important to come up with an agreement with France that Russia would sign on to ensure that the Entente powers were four square in the partition diplomacy. Now, no sooner was this agreement concluded, and Sir Mark Sykes came home with the final results, than officials not far from here on Whitehall were furious and denounced his efforts entirely because he had given far too much to France. And in the course of the war, Britain was clearly beginning to define territories that it had strategic interests in, none more important than Palestine, in the whole experience of trying to defend the Suez Canal from the Ottomans in 1915 and 1916. That experience had shown the British that you needed to secure water resources of southern Palestine to defend the Sinai and the Suez Canal. They hadn't realized it until they had to go to war to reclaim that territory, a process that took them over a year of laying railways and water pipelines to get there. But that's how you understand Balfour Declaration. It's not actually the conversion of Lloyd George and his cabinet to the vision of a historic restoration of the Jewish people to their biblical homeland. It was using the leverage of the Zionist movement to have the moral cause to renegotiate Sykes-Picot with the French. It looked like the British were giving Palestine to the Zionist movement. Trust me, it was the British using Zionism to secure Palestine for themselves. And the process only comes to its ultimate conclusion in San Remo, when Britain now has a very different position in the Middle East. Its armies had fought long and protracted battles that consumed hundreds of thousands of soldiers and all the supporting material it took to make that war in both Mesopotamia and from the Suez Canal zone through the Sinai, Palestine, and Syria. Suddenly, it was British soldiers in possession of occupied enemy territory and were in the position of power to negotiate what would be the distribution of territory that best advanced the interests of the British Empire. And that is San Remo. Whether it was a success or a failure, well, we have enough turbulence in the Middle East today that we can link back to challenges to the borders that resulted from that conflict, rather from that diplomacy. But I would put to you that by and large it was more successful than it was a failure. Because however enduring those problems have been, I would say that the state system as we know it, resulting from that wartime diplomacy, will survive the challenges of a movement like Daesh or the Islamic State, and will, through external and internal actors, prove to be far more enduring yet. It wouldn't surprise me if in 100 years' time they're still talking about those boundaries when they're commemorating the bicentenary of Sykes-Picot.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's amazing what you've done with this think tank. It's really a sort of centre for thinking about foreign policy in Britain. And incredibly, I really value my association with your organisation. I'm not going to come at this event with the authority or the knowledge of most of the people. You made the mistake of showing me the guest list. They're mostly incredibly much more distinguished and learned than I am about the Middle East, and let alone Professor Rogan. I'm not going to try and present myself as an expert on Sykes-Picot. I have had enormous fun in the last 10-15 years travelling and covering wars in the Middle East and covering the Foreign Office. I must say, a pathetic organisation. In Britain. Which clearly doesn't understand the Middle East. One reads that they did once. Anyway. I was in Iraq and I've recently spent quite a lot of time in Syria and I've been around the place. What is so exciting about one of the reasons I love doing that is that you understand that the people you meet have such a small, profound sense of that tribal, family, religious history than we do. They can trace everything back. And of course, Sykes-Picot is a living thing. in the Middle East in the way it isn't in Britain. And it's absolutely key to understanding how, I mean, just think of, you observe the endless statements by Erdogan in Turkey. It just obsesses the man. And it is a kind of narrative, it's taught in the schools, it's a narrative of colonial oppression. That's what it is now. That's part of what Sykes-Picot is now. I will introduce myself, so I forgot. I've got a book coming out in 10 days' time. I've just been to my publisher, actually. He's given me a copy. It's a very exciting moment. Not the Chilcot Report. And it's 35,000 words. The Chilcot Report is 2.6 million words. And I have a lot of very clear conclusions. The Chilcot Report won't have those. And anyway, I do recommend it. It's extraordinarily well written as well. But it's about actually dismantling of the Sykes-Picot arrangement. One of the fascinating things about Sykes-Picot, and I'm going to talk about it as a metaphor. I'm not really for the way we reconstructed the Middle East after World War I, and that means we can embrace the state of Israel. We needn't get involved in too much in what Sykes-Picot did or didn't do, and the betrayals. But clearly, a state system emerged after World War I, which was largely created by Britain, France, and was what we thought was in our interest. It worked. So the first thing to say about it is how incredibly well it worked. In a way you wouldn't have expected that Iraq, which hadn't existed and acquired a very strong, powerful national identity. Syria, likewise, Jordan, all these countries which we created out of Israel, which hadn't existed. And the fascinating... And you would have predicted, according to modern models, that they would fail because they embedded so many contradictions, religious, tribal, etc. Now, and then we decided to smash it up. That's the other very interesting thing. I don't, and this is what my book, Not the Chilcot Report, is really about, is we decided to smash it up. The neocons, the inheritors of Woodrow Wilson, they turned up, and it didn't. And they clearly didn't know what they were doing. They thought that they could sort of press a light bulb, and you'd get a new regime in Iraq. But what they did do in 2003, aided and abetted by a very immature and poorly informed British Prime Minister and a complicit British Secret Intelligence Service, and a half-witted Foreign Office, lacking any leaders of real moral character, prepared to stand up to a demented Prime Minister. And I don't think that fellow Manning is here. Is he here there? No, he's not. No. Anyway, they smashed up Iraq and created the conditions for the destruction of the state system that Britain invented with France in 1916 to 30 odd, and what that was the fascinating kind of thing that we I think that we were in trying to what we were doing in 2003 in our inchoate and baffled and half-witted way was reversing the you talked so beautifully about Professor Rogan about that. The self-interest which drove us, the creation of the Sykes-Picot and beyond. And we were, actually, I think there was a sort of kind of other inane idealism which drove us forward in 2003. Professor Joffe, your Cambridge colleague, went to advise Tony Blair. He went into Downing Street, sat opposite them. There was the Prime Minister, the head of the Secret Intelligence Service, the Foreign Secretary. And he said, "They said, what will you said to Joffe, What's going to happen after we go in? We don't know. And as Joffe said, it's going to be very complicated, very messy. There's all these problems. There's going to be an insurgency. And after a while, Blair looked at him and said, "Because Saddam Hussein is a bad man, isn't he?" Now that was the one. See, Sykes-Picot was one thing. That's our modern foreign policy. Cameron then did it in Libya, creating equal chaos and havoc. And the Foreign Office didn't advise against it, or stop it, or there were no resignations. Now, I want to move on now to the predictions, to what's happening next. And as I say, I go there quite a lot. What is interesting is that the countries which have already always been there will stay. So the Iran, which again has been completely misunderstood by the British Foreign Office, will stay. It's emerged thanks to the as a direct result of British and American foreign policy as the strongest country in the region. It has a history which goes back to the beginning of mankind, and Iran will stay. I guess the same applies to Egypt, fantastically unstable at the moment, but I don't think its integrity is under threat as a state. Iraq is finished as an independent national state, and will break up or has broken up. Let's have a think about Syria. I don't think it's quite clear at the moment. Again, the Foreign Office and the Secret Intelligence Service completely misunderstood Syria. They kept on telling the Prime Minister that Assad would fall and that we had to get rid of him. And that still hasn't happened. And I would think that Syria will survive under the Ba'athist regime. And eventually we will have to admit that the chap in charge is called Assad. But I don't know. I'm looking into the future. The big questions about the other manifestations of Sykes-Picot. Let's think about the Gulf States and Saudi Arabia. I think the Arab Spring has yet to reach those countries. I've been following the fortunes of bin Salman with increasing fascination. He's got a very good team of PR advisors. You know, all the Economist newspaper has written him up, and Newsweek and Time magazine. And I don't know who he's paying, but they're certainly worth it for the PR. Now, whether the strategy works as well as the PR, I doubt very much. I then reflected back to 19. How much longer have I got, Michael?
4 minutes.
I then reflected back to 1916 or so, right? And when we had the capacity to make maps of the world, who has that capacity today? Well, it's not Britain and it's not France, and America is gone into retreat. Not before time, and I might argue that the new security architecture in the Middle East wake up, hello Foreign Office, is Russia, Iran, Syria with a battle-hardened army, Hezbollah, backed by China. Those seem to me the five powers which are most effective, have shown far more understanding of what's actually going on in the region, and probably represent the future of the region. I know we keep on reading half-baked speeches by the Foreign Secretary, clearly doesn't know what's going on, but I do read what Lavrov says and Putin says. And right from the start of the Arab Spring and this conflict, they've understood the future, and the British and the Americans, although I think Kerry is much more intelligent than he pretends to be, and the same applies to Obama, have understood the course of this conflict. So far, we have to accept that Iran, Russia, have called it right, that Assad has survived, the Ba'athist regime has survived, and Hezbollah has proved an incredibly strong fighting force, China overlooking the whole lot. And I think that it doesn't really matter what we agree at the UN, it doesn't really matter what we agree at all these conferences around the world, before our eyes, but amazingly we haven't noticed, we do have a new security architecture in the Middle East. Thank you very much.